Folks, welcome to a very special Bay Area edition of The Corner Store. I'm your host, Kevin Coble, and I am out on the campus of St. Mary's College with the incredible and legendary Bay Area journalist and scholar and historian, a man who has put on for the culture tirelessly. David D. is in The Corner Store. Welcome, sir.
Good to be on here. How you doing, brother?
I'm good, man. Thank you so much, man. And we just had a really interesting 45-50 minute conversation with some of the students at St. Mary. But I'm excited to, even in your bio, man, I did not know that. I'm not surprised, but you used to rhyme back in the day.
These are facts. I was in a couple of crews. One was out of Co-op City, called TDK, Total Deaf Crew. Big shout out to MC Terrorai, you know, Kerry McQuinday, right? He was the person that told me all about Rhodesia, where his father was from.
Wow.
So, you know, things like that, you don't think. Oh, he's from Terrorai, from Rhodesia. Who cares, right? And then years later, it's like, damn, man. Like, I knew when it was Rhodesia before Zimbabwe.
Right.
You know, and he was a dope MC. And we were in Section 2 of Co-op City, just for receipts, you know. We had DJ G. We had Mystery. Was it Mystery? I'm trying to remember the third MC that was in the crew. And then the other crew was, out of the Promenade in the Marble Hill area near Riverdale in the Bronx, on the west side of the Bronx. And so we were called the Avengers. So we had a guy named Jazzy J, not to be confused with Jazzy J, Van Botten's Jazzy J,
right.
But he called himself Jazzy J.
Yeah.
There was Artie Art, Arthur Marklin, myself, and that's what we did, you know.
Now, what years is this?
We're talking about probably 78, 79, 1980, those are years.
So you've been into and privy to the culture from Jump Street.
Yeah, the first time I was introduced to hip-hop was 1976 in June, right? And it was on the Circle Line boat ride. And, I remember being there, and there was, a school dance, we'll say, that was taking place, and Jam on the Groove played. Yeah, I never knew that song. I just knew that the DJ, you know, kept playing it back over and over, and it wasn't like I saw the DJ mixing records. You know, you didn't have a concept to stand around and go, what is he doing? You know, we just kept hearing the same thing over and over again, and people were dropping to the floor, and they weren't doing backspins, but they were doing, you know, like corkscrews, like you put your right knee behind your left leg, you drop down, you spin around, you come up. The Freak was just about coming out around that time, and that was my introduction. And then I used to make pause button tapes, so I still have those pause button tapes.
Yo, I love pause button tapes, which is lost on maybe a lot of our listeners. These are cassettes that you would actually make a mix on from the simple technology of just hitting the cassette tape.
Right, and in our case, it was getting the breaks. And so I would go down to Downstairs Records on 42nd.
Which is such an important place for the music, because it was one of the few spaces where you would get put on to go and request certain records that were popping in the park jams.
Mm-mm. That's true, but there was a hierarchy to it. So let me explain how breakbeats worked for those who weren't in a hierarchy.
Please.
So you would hear tapes, and you would try to grab some things. And at that time, none of the records had their true names. So, like, you know, Take Me to the Mardi Gras by Bob James, it's called Breaking Bells, you know, or some sort of variation of that. Catch a Groove was Catch a Groove, right? But you didn't know it was by Juice. Big Beat, Billy Squire. Fruit Song, which was a reggae song that was sped up to 45. You know, there was all these different breakbeats. And while those were kind of staples that kind of made their way around either through word of mouth, or you would hear them on a tape, or somebody would tell you if you heard them at a jam, then there was you trying to find them. And so, you know, myself, I would look through my parents' records, and I actually did find a couple of breaks. You know, one of them was Harry Nilsson's Rainmaker. And I will, to this day, give myself props for having that record before anybody. Now, I'm sure other people discovered it, but here's the thing about that record. That Harry Nilsson record, I think, had The Most Beautiful Girl. I think that was the song. And there were only some of the 45s had on the flip side Rainmaker. So it has this drum beat, boom, 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 boom. First day in August, last spring within May, right? So I had a copy of that, and I wanted to get another copy. And I was down in the Village. So not every, you know, you didn't always go to Downstairs Records because you played top price. You know, if you want a record, it was like $5, $10 for a 45. So if you could figure out that record and you could go to another store and get it, that's how you were able to save money.
Yeah.
So I remember I went down to, I was at the store, and I saw the record, and I flipped it on the other side, and I was like, oh, this must be it, and I played it. And then I hear somebody in the back, what's the name of that record? And I turn around, it was Afrika Bambaataa. And, you know, and Bam, you know, at that time was feared. You know, I mean, yeah, we knew him, Zulu Nation, all that, but he was still, Zulu was still not to be toyed with, right? So I lived in Soundview, so that kind of helps, but it was like, oh, snap, that's him. And he's asking what's the name of his record. And I go, I think it's, you know, first day in August, right? So I don't say it's Rainmaker, you know?
You don't want to put him on.
No, I'm not trying to put him on, you know?
Yeah.
And so he goes up to the counter to find out something. I forget why he went up to the counter or whatever. But there were like four records, so I took all of them. And, you know, and I went up and paid for, you know, the records I didn't need for. But I was like, nobody's getting this record. And I would say about a year later, I'm hearing this Armory Jam and Sundance is on there. And then I hear, you know, first day in August, you know. Now, you know, the joke was, and I said this to him when I ran into him about that. Like, man, you all tried to get that record for me, and I had it first. And he's like, oh, no, what the hell you talking about? But that's my claim to fame, that I definitely had that breakbeat.
Yeah.
But I think all of us.
You got a lot of other claims to fame.
But I think everybody at that time always was trying to find that one record.
Yes, yeah.
That you could be
finding, like, the fresh, finding the new,
finding,
right?
Something
it's
new,
built
yeah.
in, built into the culture, really.
And going to Downstairs, there was that hierarchy. So I've been downstairs when Flash and others had gone there, right? And keep in mind, you know, you just, you know, you don't know these people. I don't know them like that. So it's like, oh, that's Grandmaster Flash,
right?
You know,
you'd
Flash,
only seen them.
They're there.
Presume, yeah.
I mean, yeah, you know,
right.
All kind of people would go down there,
right.
So you would see folks.
Yeah,
but those people had juice. And so, you know, here you go, man. Here's your two copies of Catch a Groove for $5. And you're sitting there in the background trying to ear hustle, like, yo, can I get a copy of that? Yeah, $10. No, I just need one. $10. You know, so that's how it was. But if you went to Downstairs, you could probably find just about every breakbeat. And they would accommodate you and, you know, give you the record by its false name, you know, whatever street name you had, or sometimes you just hung out there and hoped that you could, you know, soak up some game. Like, so that's how it was. But the trick was to take those records, figure out the name of those records, and then go to another store.
Right.
And
get them for low. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I stayed in Riverdale for a while. So that was the white part of town. And, you know, there were record stores up there on Broadway. And
now, what did your folks do?
My father drove a truck. My mom was somebody who worked in a bank, one of the first black people to work in a bank. And
what did they think about your, you know, early steps into this emergent youth culture?
You know, they thought that it was kind of corny that I was playing these records that made no sense. You know, like Trans Europe Express, you know, like, listen to this. It's like, well, what? I don't get it. You know, listen to this. Here's a computer games, Yellow Magic Orchestra. this what you like, you know. So I don't think my parents ever heard me rhyme, right? So I don't think they knew that that's what I did, you know, on my free time. And my pops at the time didn't know that his pristine turntable, which was belt-driven on a couple occasions, had left the house, you know, and went to, Arthur Markland's house to supplement his parents' turntable, where, you know, we tried to mimic and do what we saw going on. Right. So that's how that was. You know, that's for the people who were in that second tier.
Right. Now, what drew you to rhyming?
I was good at it. I was actually pretty good MC, and people have heard my tapes, liked them, and I MC'd actually when I moved out to Cali, and I did a song called South Africa, which was played during an apartheid rally. Oh, never made a record, but I was actually a pretty good rhymer.
Yeah, well, you got the voice for sure.
I don't know if I have the voice, but I definitely had flow.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say I was a battle rapper or anything like that, but I definitely was no slouch, and I have nice size rhyme book and a lot of tapes that we did. So that was my thing. You know, I could definitely get down. But when I moved out here...
And what brought you out here?
Two things. My mom had moved out here while I was still in high school. And so I stayed in New York to finish up. And, stayed with my grandparents and, was back in Soundview. And it made no sense for me to move out to Cali with them and not complete my years at Bronx Science. So I went to Science with Barry Bistro, was there, and there at the time, a kid from Kid and Play.
Right.
You know.
So many folks, really, I mean, even since, have gone Bronx Science.
Yeah, but at that time, you know, we came out that era.
Yeah.
But, you know, Grandmaster Flash performed there, you know, Breakout. The first time I seen Shaw Rock was at Science, had a dance there. Tewitt Clinton was down the street. But I moved out here. When I came out here, I was of an age where my mom was still, you know, my legal guardian. And so I was a California resident, technically, even when I lived in New York, which allowed me to get California prices for tuition. Well, actually, I was the last one under the old rules to get, you know, the California residency price. So I was going to go to Howard. Howard was going to give me X amount of dollars for financial aid. You know, Cal Berkeley was like $200 a semester if you were a California resident. You know, so my mom was like, you know, you're still of age, so you're going to go to Cal. And they tried to flip the rules on us when we came. My mom went down there, had a conversation with the president, David Gardner, and he even said, you will be the last person who will get into UC Berkeley under these old rules, because they had changed it. And the rest is history.
So you're a New York hip-hop kid coming to live in California.
Mm-hmm.
What? I mean, that must have been disconcerting. What was the cultural scene,
It's a huge cultural divide and difference. Obviously I'm up on the campus, so I'm not in the East and West Oaklands. I'm running into a lot of people from LA, so people heard about some of this, and it was an interesting type of encounter with people, because it was into funk, and it was into a different brand of funk than I was. You know, Roger Zapp and all that was their thing. And it was about dancing and, you know, and people, you know, and it'd be like, oh yeah, there's somebody that rhymes. This couple of guys out of, you know, Richmond, Commander C, you know, they rhyme, you know. So it was something like that, but that was not their main focus. Their focus was funk. Mm. And I used to rhyme at some of the parties over Rick James, you know. I came up under a DJ that was here by the name of Ben Gold. And so he would throw all the big parties, and I would go to the parties, and he'll let me rap at the end. So I kind of had a little rep for that.
And what was that reception like? I mean, I imagine people, that those people, might be people. Some of the first parties people might have heard a rapper live.
No, they heard rap before, but they never heard it like that.
Word.
And so, yeah, people, you know, people liked it. It was like, oh, man, you're pretty good at that, man. That's good. You know, and then eventually I started to DJ. And by about 84, 85... I completely switched over into DJing. I mean, it's this, you know, if you, this, there's definitely video up at the UC Berkeley archives because I used to put on an event called, what was it called? It was the Day of Hip Hop or something like that. So I brought all these things together. So there is, there's probably some on YouTube with me on there going way back,
nice.
You know, to that time. So I don't know if it has me rhyming, but, you know, there's definitely tapes and a lot of witnesses that seen that.
Well, so, you know, of course, I know you as a DJ on the radio, as a journalist as mm-hmm. well, and, you know, late historian and archivist. You switched from rhyming to DJing. What made you make that transition?
It was just easier to do. People weren't, there was no community for rhyming in the same way.
Mm.
You know, it wasn't an activity. It wasn't a prevalent activity the way it was when I was in New York. And you got to remember, I'm in a crew. But you also got to remember, by the time I'm leaving New York, right, records were being made. And so once we realized records were being made, there was an attempt to maybe step up our skill level and see if we could get to make records. But, you know, it's like, how are we going to make a record? Who do you talk to? Do we go down to Chicago? You know, so, and then when I moved out here, everything froze in time, right? So, you know, whole different world. And when I said it was a culture shock, when you're from New York, you're used to New York being such a centerpiece. So at that time, you know, if I'm from New York, people are like, ooh, New York, Harlem, the Bronx, you know, it kind of meant something. Right? And it was only one city that was never impressed with your New Yorkness, and that was Washington, D.C. And Washington, D.C. is like, yeah, you know, we're Chocolate City. You know, we're 90% black. So what? Right? And so when I moved out here, you know, people were like, they could care less about New York, right? You know, like Oakland was like, oh, you know, I have a cousin there. I went there once. There was no animosity or anything, so they didn't care. They didn't think. It didn't resonate. Like, you're from New York. There was none of that, like, ooh. It was just like, all right.
Yeah, it was just a place.
Just keep moving.
Right.
And so years later, you can understand that Oakland has a very incredible history. You know, it's the home of the Panthers. You know, my mom was friends with Huey's brother. You know, Melvin, so those became my godparents. So, you know, so that's a whole rich history. It was the Raiders. It was the Oakland A's. And when you look back, you also understand that Oakland is a very, very strongly identified city, and the Bay itself in general is that way. So the Bay doesn't have a second city complex. It's just the Bay.
Right.
And, you know, cities that are like Detroit. It's just Detroit, right? And what I mean by that is, like, you go to the Bay, and there's a reason why you don't see Bloods and Crips here. Because L.A. is 400 miles away, and it's like, we don't do that.
We're the Bay, right?
Yeah. And, you know, same thing with Detroit. It doesn't really have Chicago's. You know, you go to Detroit, you're from Chicago. You step in Detroit, it's like, I'm from Chicago. And it's like, yeah,
and,
okay, this is Detroit,
yeah.
Right? And so, same thing, you know, and so it's a very independent city, and it has a hustle mentality, and a lot of that is where I cut my teeth. That's where I, you know, my adulthood years got formed, and
in terms of
you know, there was obviously New York gave me a lot of foundation, but the Bay honed that the same way it did with Pac, who moved out here.
Mm.
The Bay is just it's a different type of place. It's a rough and tumble place. It's a loving place. It's a you know, when once you're nestled into it, you understand it's a hustle place, right? People look at things and they go, you know, BET is out. Well, we'll get our own BET. That's the Bay, right?
Right.
The Bay's attitude is, oh, them cats is wearing gold chains. I don't want a gold chain. I'm going to own house deeds, right? So you talk to somebody like a 40 or somebody like, I got three houses. I got a chain. I got three houses, you know, and they'll, you know, that's what I got. You know, I own property. I bought up this block. So that sort of mentality of making a way out of no way, but on an entrepreneurial slash hustle tip, is the thing that I picked up here. And so, you know, if you look at the things that I did early on that put me on the map, it was always that resourcefulness. Like, I'm not on the radio. Well, we'll figure out how to get on the radio. Now that we're on the radio, we're going to figure out what to do to elevate your position on radio. And so it was always the next step, but it was methodical. It was a hustle motif, and it was one that was almost expected of you. Like, you're in this position, you better elevate up. And when you start looking at everybody that's come up at that time, let's say it's Sway and King Tech, myself, Fred Reck, you know, producers with Dre. I mean, we can go down the list. All those artists, you know, from Mystic Journeyman down to Souls of Mischief, to E-40, to Too Short. It's all the same trajectory of people just looking at a situation and figuring out, okay, here's the wall that's got to be climbed. How are we going to climb it? And this is how you do it. And with that hustle is not just, you know, the goal is not so much to get a job or to be put on and to be seen. I think people here kind of resign themselves to knowing that I'm not going to be on TV, I'm not going to be on radio, but I'm going to own the things that I create. I'm going to have, you know, what we now would call wealth. So I own all my writing. I own all my interviews. You know, those types of things are gold. You know, I have, you know, those type of assets. And I think if you talk to my peers, they have those same things too. That's that type of mentality. So,
well, you've seen the development of the whole Bay Area scene. I mean, from mm-hmm. what sounds like and what I presume to be the nascent stages, and you're who I associate with, a keeper of that history.
Let me be clear about a couple of things. There's a black perspective that comes out of the Bay, and then there's everybody else. And so there is a scene in the Bay Area. There's a funk movement that exists in the Bay that predates hip-hop the way that we know it. And at the same time that New York had hundreds of crews, you know, between the years 76 up into Sugar Hill Gang, right? The Bay has hundreds of garage bands, in particular in Oakland. 3 and 4 member bands, which are the equivalent to the 3 or 4 member crews that we have. And those bands attracted a lot of dancers. And these dancers were doing things like boogalooing, strutting, roboting. If you went down to L.A., it was locking and popping. And, you know, Fresno had its scene. And so you have this ecosystem, this dance music ecosystem that exists. So the reason why I emphasize this blackness is because when hip-hop from New York emerges in the form of Sugar Hill, maybe myself or Kevy Kev, who went to Stanford, you know, and others that are coming up, black folks are like, yeah, that kind of reminds me of Dolomite. Oh, yeah, that kind of reminds me of, you know, Red Fox, right? So they reference it. Y'all doing what my uncle did, right? So, yeah. So they might take bits and pieces. Well, that's a different way of doing it. So they'll take bits and pieces. But they're not enamored with New York that way. So they take some of those things and they incorporate it into, oh, yeah, Tracy knows.
What's
sit
that?
Down, Tracy.
What's
you
that?
Need to, you need to sit her down and get some of this, yeah, this history.
Yeah. Okay.
She got this
please,
history.
Please, please.
Yeah. So that's Tracy Bartlow, if you don't know.
Of course, no, shout out. Yeah.
So I know some stuff, but she knows everything. But what I'm saying is that black folks took bits and pieces and they incorporated into things that they were doing. And when hip-hop shows up, there are people outside the black community Asian folks, white folks, not so much Latinos, but other groups that become like disciples of New York hip hop. So they pick up everything and they're soaking up, oh, I seen Beat Street and all that. And so a very interesting thing develops, which is you could be in an area where somebody like Too Short comes up and he's doing things that are going to be indigenous to Oakland. His style of music, you know, that, you know, Ant Banks or, you know, Al Eaton, who came from band culture, is doing that slow rolling funk that everybody could get into. And you could have somebody else who is coming up who's like, didn't ever lived in Oakland, but knows hip hop from TV and what they seen with New York and some of the artists that come out here who follow that, who would be like, Too Short's not hip hop. Well, what are you talking about? Well, you know, because he doesn't rhyme and, you know, so they have a New York aesthetic, and then there's a Black Bay aesthetic. And that aesthetic, I think, of having your own way of presenting is something that you could find in LA. You find it in Detroit. You find it everywhere. It's just not often held up as something that we needed to really explore further, because the New York model has a date, time, and place, and a very strong insistence that what they did is the only thing that matters when dance and vocal expression is something that was going to happen and was happening all over the country at the same time. So, you know, the uniqueness is that I got to see both. You know, I got to come out of it as it was emerging in New York, and I got to see something, you know, that luckily I was able to see those parallels there.
Yeah, no, that's an amazing moment. I wonder if most cities who receive the export of hip-hop cultural practice go through a similar transition period where they're trying to incorporate local, indigenous style, sound, language.
Well, eventually they do, but this is why I said with Oakland, it's its own city, and there's a few cities that are like it. So Detroit, I look to, you know, Oakland, maybe Houston, it's like that, right? These are cities that are kind of like, we're on thing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
New Orleans is kind of like that, we're on thing,
Chicago,
right?
Was resistant to hip-hop because of house, and there was that hybrid of hip-house.
But Chicago always had a second city complex.
Yeah.
Right? And it had a second city complex. At the same time, it was also a juggernaut. So Chicago's footprint is seen in Milwaukee. Chicago's footprint is seen in Milwaukee and all these cities in the Midwest.
Yeah.
So it's
capital
a big juggernaut. Yeah. It's like L.A.
Yeah.
And it's like New York, right? But then I look to the cities that are kind of like, yeah, you do that Chicago. That would be Detroit.
Right.
We don't do that.
Right.
So, and when you, and that's where you find a whole different type of approach towards music. So what is Chicago does, it's house, and Detroit has techno.
Right.
You do juking, they do jitting, right?
Yeah.
So it's no mistake.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. So of course, so you saw it emerge, and you saw it kind of form. At what point did you start to kind of advocate for it as not only a practitioner, but as someone who then went to the side of radio and began to incorporate some of that into what you would play? Or
I wouldn't say with an advocacy. I just think it was a natural extension of what was happening. I was DJing already. So that was first and foremost. And when I came into radio, I came in under two people. One was a guy named Natty Prep, who was one of the people that was part of Time X Social Club in terms of how they kind of position themselves. He was doing a show called Music for the People, which they actually had to fight for. You know, like guns get pulled and shit goes all the way up to the California State Legislature, which is UC Berkeley Station, which you have to have the Sunday morning show. So I get trained through that.
Why radio? Why did you gravitate toward radio?
Because that was the place I could DJ.
Right.
You know, I could DJ there. So there was a bunch of people that was on that show. One is named CJ Flash, who was called LA Sounds. There was another guy named Ricky Vincent who did the History of Funk. And then I came on, and with another guy named Billy Jan, you know, a white dude, who pulled some strings so I could be approved to do a whole bunch of shows. You know, so I got my own show in 86, 87, on Monday night. And it was on that show I had a decision to make. It was like I could do flyers that said, listen to the show, or I could do a newsletter that explained what I was playing. So it was through that newsletter called the WDB Report that became the thing that we call advocacy. So that became a thing that I was printing out. How you doing with us?
You're all good.
I was printing out records that I was playing, and it was a mixture at that time, Latin freestyle and hip hop. And I would do a top 20 chart, and then underneath it, I would write a little something I was playing. So Miami bass was starting to come up, and I would use the station's not email, but their stamp system, and I would collect as many names and numbers as I could, and I would send those playlists out. And so that's kind of how I got known, was through that. So I think at its high point, it might have been sending out 600, 700 copies a week of that. And
with the addition of this textual component, where you were breaking down some of what?
I was just playing stuff on the radio, but it was the newsletters that people got to read. And since I took your name and address, it wasn't a thing like I needed to call or anything. I just, you know, Chuck D got one. It's like, what is this? So that's how I met him. Russell Simmons got one. That's how I met them. So I was sending these things out. So it allowed me not to have these awkward conversations, but you had like tangible stuff. And then I would put them in record stores, and I left a little blank space so that you could put the name of the store at the bottom of the thing. So Star Records had their own playlist, Rasputin's, Leopold's, you know, the Pros Record Pool. So there's all these different places that I would put those. And then I was using those newsletters in a very creative way to get hired. So I started sending them out to the big station, which was KMEL. And the tactic that I used was I got a black envelope with gold writing, and I sent it to the people that ran the station. But then there was a fear of influence. So we look and we're saying, who's the secretary? Who's the other DJs? Who's the janitor? And we send copies of that same newsletter to them. And so they, and then we would mention the station. It's like, oh yeah, you know, we would mention something, and that's how I got to know them. And also I started inviting all the DJs onto the show to do a set. So it was a little bit of hustle. It was that hustle I was talking about.
And then at some point, would artists reach out to you to get records broke?
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
And so that's how you began also to develop some of those relationships.
Relationships to this day.
Right.
You know, so, yeah, it was that. Those were, you know, from everybody from X-Clan on down. It was because of the newsletter.
Right, yeah, and you became kind of a if you were in the Bay, people would want you to play their record or to...
Well, there was another station called KPU, which was a black-owned community station. So Sundays, that was their day. They had a good relationship with Russell Simmons and Def Jam. There was KVSU with Kevy Kev on Sunday nights. And then we all formed together and formed this thing called the Bay Area Hip Hop Coalition. And then that's kind of... And then we changed the name of the Beat Report, and we aggregated all that, and so that made us all one unit. But by then, I was going back and forth to LA. People were traveling. The music industry had opened up a little more, and we started to develop these different type of relationships. You out of here?
Mm-hmm.
So you need to talk to her, because you grab a mic. I want you to fill in the gap here.
Sure. I mean, if you
sit down.
Okay, I have a moment.
Okay, yeah. Tracy was an incredible dancer, choreographer, educator.
Well, but more than that, because we're talking about how things transpire. So while I'm doing this stuff, you know, on my show, her ass is in New York at the Latin Quarter. You want to tell them about that? Yeah, so she's bringing Oakland flavor to New York in the middle of...
First.
Yeah,
wow.
So
I had this unique experience of... I went to New York to study at the Alvin Ailey School. And I got into the hip hop and house clubs in New York in the 80s, in like the mid to late 80s, as well as the early 90s. And there was a annual event in New York called the New Music Seminar. It was a big music festival.
Yeah, we all went to that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I went to an event at the Latin Quarter. And I remember the MC was like, okay, next we got somebody from Oakland. He was like, y'all got rap music out there? So it was like a period of time where it was unheard of that hip-hop would be in any other place besides New York. And people laughed. And I remember when he said Oakland, I jumped up and I was like, hey! And it was like I was the only voice other than people laughing. And it was Hammer. And so MC Hammer came out and got down. And so it was so funny because
they booed him that day, right? They booed him.
Yeah.
Now, this is why I wanted her to tell this, because the time that they booed Hammer, he was huge in Oakland. Like, mm-hmm. you couldn't go nowhere. I mean, Hammer was like the guy.
Yeah.
So here he's the guy here doing everything that you need to do, putting, you know, him and Short putting the Bay on the map. He goes to the Latin Quarter and gets booed.
Mm. Yeah, and the Latin Quarter was a legendary spot.
Yes.
You know, so I was blessed to go there a couple of times, like right before they closed. But I'll never forget that. And then to hear that him being booed and not really received at this event, you know, he goes on to make a song that sold millions of records.
It turned his mother out as his response to the booing at Latin Quarter.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Definitely say, you ain't hitting in New York, Hammer.
Yes.
And he takes a breakbeat from New York, the anthem, mm-hmm. Apache, and mm-hmm. kills it.
Woo!
And sells
yep.
14 million goddamn records.
Ain't that something?
Yes.
And then when people came out to Oakland, they realized, like, he's a real Oakland cat. Like,
right.
He was no gimmick. Like, he's a real dude.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, folks is like, don't let the genie pants fool you. He's a high street bank boy.
No.
That's right.
Tracy, if you're ever in Chicago, or
yes.
next time in the Bay, maybe I'll just...
But her history of dance.
Yeah, no, I know.
No, that's...
Yeah.
Because that's the key. That's why I wanted her here. Because I was telling them, like, you know, there was this vibrant dance scene that existed, you know, prior to and during the evolution of hip-hop in New York. And so that dance movement that's here is critically important, because now it's all umbrellaed. You know, and some of the moves that people would call hip hop, you know, it's like, well, where
right,
did
it
come
regional.
From? But it was,
yeah.
but no, but a lot of stuff comes from here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, yeah, I mean, that's
yeah.
what I said during the class. That's one of the things I shared while we were doing the class mm-hmm. in there, and all the styles that came out of the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And not just the Bay Area, actually California.
Mm-hmm.
Like when it comes to hip hop dance,
yeah, what are
and
some
the
of those
foundations,
styles,
the foundations of hip hop dance. New York has top rock, b-boying, breaking, but all the boogaloo, popping, locking,
robotting,
all of those are California innovations from Southern California all the way up to the Bay.
And not just innovations, but Michael Jackson had to come to those people to get his flavor, from locking, which you could see him and them doing, to robotting, to moonwalking, all those are street stuff, not the other way around. And that's what's really important, because I think when you see things on TV, you go, oh yeah, you all got it from Michael Jackson. No, you all got it from Michael Jackson.
Right. He got it from...
They got it from Big Louie down the block at the house party.
Yeah, no doubt.
You out of here?
I like Chicago.
We'll come through.
I've only been there a couple of times. I look forward to going back.
All right, yeah. Well, we'd love to get more time with you when you're there.
Yes,
yeah.
I would like that.
Thank you.
All right.
Yeah.
You all going
there?
Yes, I'm going to check out something. What's popping?
Okay. I don't know. I guess they have about 7,000 people. Tomorrow's supposed to be one of the big days.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
40 and everybody's supposed to be down there.
Where?
Tomorrow at, you know, that EA gaming stuff in Jack London.
Oh, Jack London? Mm-hmm. Oh, I'll be there.
I'm going to go with you. Let me get in that backpack. Well, how many people you got dancing? Let me be the fourth one.
All right,
take care.
We got to step into this play, but yeah. Before I let you go, the reason why it's called the corner store is because, that's like the local small market. But in Oakland, in the Bay, what do they call them? What do they call, like, local small convenience stores?
Well, bodegas. Not bodegas, but Mercados.
Mercados, yeah. Okay. Yeah, so this is like the Mercado edition.
Yeah.
We got to come back for, like, a round two with you, man, because I know that there's so much more, but I do...
Yeah, there's a lot there, and I appreciate the opportunity. I'll say this, is that everybody's history is important. And you know what I'm telling is unique, but it's unique, but it's also commonplace. What I mean by that is that Tracy, when she was here, she told you she could have given you that history with a different angle, yeah. Right? Because I'm a little bit older, so I have a different take on things than she does. But she's born and raised in Oakland, so there's going to be nuances and subtleties that she would bring to the picture that I wouldn't, because she went to high school. You know, so she would tell you about the talent shows that existed and how that was our equivalent to block parties, right? That every day it's like 100 talent shows with 100 bands, right? And that's where all these dancers, got known alongside bands. So they were competing with, Jay King and the Unknowns. Jay King was a dancer, before he was Club Nouveau. But they had, they had this incredible dance crew, the Black Resurgence, right, who started in 71 and wound up opening up for George Clinton in 76 and performing with Sylvester and being signed to their label and opening up for Mayor Dianne Feinstein, and the Black Messengers and the battle between the Messengers and the Resurgence. Or we could talk about Jerry Renty and his group 1+1, who predates all that because he goes back to 67. And he's talking about, how they come up with the Boogaloo, but the Boogaloo is showing up at high school football games because the best dancers were the mascots. So everybody learned the dances from the mascots who, each school had, it'd be like Crazy Legs is the mascot of DeWitt Clinton, right? And, and Ken Swift is the mascot of, Andrew Jackson High, right? So you have that type of caliber of people. So that's how it was in the town. And so you had mascots that were coming in and they were doing these crazy dances that people would pick up. And then they got exchanged to talent shows and all that. So that's an important and very, very rich history that then morphs into the hip hop day. You see what I'm saying? And people pick up and take bits and pieces. But almost everybody that you look at came out as a dancer first and then got into, but when you hear somebody like Charlie Rock talk, he's like, don't forget Flash was a dancer, right? Melly Mel was a dancer, right? So you give that whole New York history, a lot of those people were dancing early on too. So
I just so appreciate your commitment to telling a story and telling a story as important as keeping the integrity you have in telling the story.
Yeah.
We skimmed the surface and kind of did 20 years, and I want to tell the next 30 too.
Okay.
But
I'm only 25.
Fair enough. we'll get the next five. But I appreciate you, man, and there's a lot more to say. And so next time I'm in town or whenever in Chicago, hopefully we can get to part two.
Yeah.
We'd be open to it. But thanks so much for spending a little bit of time in the corner.
Thank you.
Shout out our super producer, DJ Cashera. Big up boss man, Todd Manley. Thank you to our official corner store photog, Mercedes Zapata. Salutes to the snack door, Max. Also, please, y'all, follow our Instagram. It's corner_pod on IG, on Twitter. Tell us who you want to see in the corner store. And also, please consider dropping a couple of dollars into our Patreon account. It's patreon.com/corner_pod.
The corner store is brought to you by Stolen Spirits.